The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Becca's a microbiologist from Atlanta and an activist for the Science for the People.
Yeah. And an ISO member. So, first of all, I am just deeply proud of this manifestation of human nature, that everyone had the will to get up this early on Saturday morning. Thank you so much. Welcome. Hopefully we can make some really good kind of synthesis here to help us move forward in the project of defending a real dialectical science that can take us forward. So, the title of this talk has actually been the source of some difficulties. I don't know if you all saw at the very beginning when the schedule was published, this was listed in the program as not in our genes, human nature, and evolutionary biology, in scare quotes. And it made me a little nervous because I was going to invite a bunch of my evolutionary biologist colleagues to this talk, and I didn't. You don't belong in scare quotes, I promise. So I touched base with the center, and they clarified the typo and turned it into not in our genes, human nature, and evolutionary psychology. But even with that, when I sat down to write the talk, I struggled because there's a whole lot to talk about with respect to the ideological purposes of genetics. And there's also a whole other talk about psychology, why we think the way we think. And so I had a difficulty with it, but it was only in the process of finalizing this talk that I realized what the name should have been. It should either be biological mythologies or mythological biologies. And I'm gonna poll the audience at the end to see which one it is that we make together in this space today. So biology, the study of life. Mythology, quote, a traditional story, especially one concerning the early history of a people or explaining a natural or social phenomena involving supernatural beings or events. But the second listed definition is widely held but false belief or idea. So this is a commonly held, non-scientific story about the way that life works, the way that human beings work. And that's what I'm going to talk about today, that mythology. The three relevant fields that make the best myths about humans are sociobiology, evolutionary psychology, and behavioral genetics. And I'm going to take a second to describe them and their origins, and then we'll touch on the basics of genetics and evolution, and then we'll discuss our new knowledge as a form of critique of these different ideologies. And finally, I'll put forward what I consider a much more evidence-based framework for what we consider human nature. So although they use different lenses, sociobiology, evolutionary psychology, and behavioral genetics are all examples of biological determinism. This is the idea that basically biology is destiny. Biological determinism as an ideology predates modern genetics, finding its origin in the 18th century, but it really came to fruition in the late 19th in the intellectual milieu around Charles Darwin. Darwin's friend, Herbert Spencer, was very excited after reading Origin of the Species. He found great parallels between those evolutionary theories and his own ideas about economics. He was actually the one who coined the phrase survival of the fittest. And this became popularized with the Hobbesian conception of all against all. And then we see Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton. I was pausing here for the booze. I assume that this audience would be like, woo! Francis Galton, he came on the scene, and in 65, he published an article entitled Hereditary Talent and Character, where he claimed that talent is biologically determined and proposed a program of better breeding practices. Yeah, this is why the boo. later he refined this proposal, giving the name eugenics, meaning good birth. In one book, Hereditary Genius, he traced the family lines of the rich and prestigious in England and used that as proof that, as the title suggests, talent is inherited. So he decided a priori that it was nature, not nurture. And he also placed his racial stereotypes into the nature category, claiming that black people were inherently less intelligent and Jewish people were, quote, specialized for a parasitical existence. Yeah. This was an ideology well suited to the political climate in the US at the time. It was for justifying native genocide, basically, and chattel slavery, and attacks on immigrants. One of the leading eugenicists in the US, Charles Davenport, it was especially blunt. He said, though capital punishment is a crude method of grappling with the difficulty of those with inferior genes, it is infinitely superior to that of training the feeble-minded and criminalistic and letting them loose upon society, permitting them to perpetuate in their offspring these animal traits. Yeah. This language was adopted by the Nazi Party in Germany, leading to, as we know, devastating consequences. But this also led to a real but very short-lived turn away from biological determinism in the global scientific community. Biological determinism needed rebranding in order to regain a seat at the ideological table. And the new name was sociobiology. The father of this new attempt to explain social phenomena as biological dictates was instigated by a man named E.O. Wilson. So he was an entomologist. And essentially, he looked at hierarchy in insects and said, wow, there's also hierarchy in humans. And so hierarchy must be in the DNA. Like that, it's slightly flippant, but that was kind of his starting point. The idea is that by examining non-human animal behavior as well as universal human behaviors, you can gain insight into the biological basis for why we do what we do. Wilson used a framework of natural selection to explain the existence of human traits as diverse as entrepreneurship, civility, spite, conformity, xenophobia, and even homosexuality. For sociobiology, the premise is that behaviors are inherited, and if they exist at all, they must be the product of natural selection. You're allowed to laugh there. Sociobiology was vigorously debated, especially by members and supporters of a left-wing science organization called Science for the People. And its influence, because of this fight, somewhat waned. But two newer forms of biological determinism have emerged, in part as responses to some of the critiques of sociobiology. Each in their own way is more reductionist, however. They reduce complex phenomena to smaller units in order to say something that's slightly more accurate. But then they use the insight from that to scale up and say that explains the whole phenomena. And it's a logical trick that leads to profoundly wrong-headed conclusions. First, evolutionary psychology. It's a field that investigates how our evolutionary history has shaped the way that our minds work. Steven Pinker is an excellent example of this field. And he's pretty blunt about his conclusions. Oppression, exploitation, and war are all hardwired into our brains. He attacks, quote, Marxists, academic feminists, and cafe intellectuals. I shiver to think what he would think of all three. And says that their ideas about human nature have been refuted by many sources of evidence, including the anthropological record and Darwinian theory. We'll see. In response to criticism of sociobiology that behaviors were complex phenomena, evolutionary psychologists have reduced behavior to psychological modules, distinct and predictable processes. And these are sometimes even mapped to specific areas in the brain. The idea is that if behavior is too complex a trait to be acted on by natural selection, these modules might be just right. And the modules that we have processing in our brains now come from the dawn of the human species, according to this field. They look to the conditions of the Pliocene as the environment that would favor or eliminate traits, i.e. modules, through differential reproductive success, natural selection. A different take on reviving the soul of sociobiology is behavioral genetics. This one is older, involving animal models and twin studies, but there's a reboot recently that is thanks to new technologies in DNA sequencing. Now, just be aware that these people don't call themselves behavioral geneticists. I call them behavioral geneticists. Just, yeah, work with me here. You know, whereas it took a month to sequence a single gene in the 1980s, a whole human genome can be sequenced in a day now. And this has led to a mountain of studies claiming to discover genes that determine human behaviors or complex traits. Intelligence is one of the favorites for this field, but they also like going after mental or cognitive health issues. So now it's time for a quick primer in genetics and evolutionary biology in order to engage in a serious critique of these versions of biological mythology. So, DNA is made of a combination of adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. In pieces of DNA that have the name gene, the order of these four molecules determine the order of the amino acids in a protein. And proteins do the majority of the heavy lifting in our cells. That's an oversimplified version. The devil is in the details. The presence of a particular stretch of DNA is only a tiny clue as to the function. For example, I have the same genome in my eyeball that I do in my heart, right? And yet, these have very, very different functions, thank goodness, right? One of the ways that a single genome can code for many cell types is through the regulation of which genes get turned into proteins at particular times or locations in multicellular organisms like me. But I'm also a four-dimensional creature. Different proteins were made in my body at different times in my life. Also, even after being made, proteins carry out different functions in different chemical environments. Cells can also change which genes they express based on the cells nearby and the molecules they're making. And an important example of this is development. Each and every person in this room was once a single cell, right? A single cell. And when that cell divided, it began to make different molecules, different signals, that told the next set of cells to make yet another set of signals that helped the process of what's called differentiation. So all from a single cell, we then spread out into different genetic fates. And this, all of these inputs in space and time, collaborate to create all biological entities. The famous and accurate quote that nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution is important here, and its misuse is therefore especially troubling. In order to evaluate evolutionary psychology and sociobiology, we should touch on the basics of the field. A really important point about evolution is that it can be defined as a change in allelic frequencies. This means a change in how often you would see a specific stretch of DNA if you sampled completely randomly. So how often you would see it, 90% of the time, 20% of the time, so on and so forth. An individual cannot evolve. Only populations or species can. Evolution happens when forces act on pre-existing genetic diversity. If populations were genetically identical, no evolution could ever occur. This diversity comes from mostly random changes in the DNA, and the forces that act on that variation are genetic drift, natural selection, and non-random mating. This is a mild oversimplification if I have evolutionary biologists in the crowd, but basically, yeah. Genetic drift is evolution due to chance. If there were 50 elephants, 25 of whom were hairy, and 25 of whom were less so, and a huge sinkhole formed, and 20 of the hairy ones and only 2 of the non-hairy ones died in the sinkhole, evolution would have happened. A change in allelic frequencies would have happened, but it's not related to the hair. The hair didn't drag them into the sinkhole. And so it's important to see that genetic drift can be an incredibly powerful force, especially in small populations, to evolve, to change those allelic frequencies. Another less familiar force is non-random mating. This refers to a whole bunch of phenomena where there's some sort of selection of partners. So there are these tan striped sparrows, and in the same species, the other sparrows have white stripes. So it's all the same species. The tan sparrows always like to partner with the white, and vice versa. You almost never find tan partnering with tan or white partnering with white. A lot of speculation occurs about these types of non-random mating preferences. That's called disassociative. But sometimes explanations make sense, and sometimes they're pretty ridiculous. But the vast majority, even in non-human animals, are speculative at best. And then we come to natural selection. This is differential reproduction of organisms as a function of heritable traits that influence adaptation to the environment. Meaning, translating, trait X in environment Y tends to help you have more babies that have babies. That's what that means. And this eventually changes the frequencies we talked about earlier causing evolution. So, now that we're armed, let's take a look at some of those myths. A 2015 paper entitled, 2015, note that, entitled Sociobiology of Lethal Violence in Small-Scale Societies had a pretty entertaining story to tell. The authors assert a survey of ethnographic material on small-scale societies yields three main conclusions. One, lethal interpersonal and or intergroup violence, meaning murder or warfare, are virtually universal characteristics of these societies. Two, males are everywhere the principal predators and victims of lethal violence. Three, the causes of lethal violence are ultimately connected to reproductive competition. It's great. You get yourself ready. So the story here is that access to women is the limiting factor for men to make lots of babies. Because women can't produce babies as quickly as men since we gestate, our availability determines their availability to spread their seed far and wide. The implication here is that a man who would not murder and go to war would have less time with the ladies due to too many other men. That's what they're saying here. Fiction, in case you hadn't guessed. First, the ethnographic data that they used was a sad hodgepodge of different methodologies and conflicting definitions. It included missionaries' diaries from the 1600s and things that are pretty reputable, like a 40-year longitudinal study of the Kong San. Second, they acknowledge that in modern large-scale societies, murder rates correlate most highly with economic and social inequality. And even in small societies, so that's why they chose small societies, even in small societies, when they compare murder rates between different political economies, hunter-gatherer versus pastoral, they find what they call a bimodal distribution, meaning correlations between political economy and murder rates. And then, after they have that figure one, it is their figure one, they say, but anyway, murder's universal. And move right on. They just keep going. They go on to explain that it is mostly men who commit murder, and mostly men who are the victims. We could ask questions about how they defined murder, warfare, or even for that matter, men, since we know that in pre-class societies and now, that's not actually so simple. But taking their conclusions at face value, let's examine the evolutionary explanation. Unfettered access to the ladies. First, even dogged male promiscuity has limited benefits. Because randomly timed sex will impregnate a healthy woman only about 3% of the time, author Cordelia Fine finds that a man would have to have sex with more than 130 women just to have a 90% chance of beating the fertility odds of a monogamous couple. 130 women. That's, yeah, daunting. lost my place, it was remarkable. That means that in these small-scale societies, with murder rates at 2 to 5 murders per 100,000, the reproductive advantage of the opportunity to sleep with 130 women is basically zero. This, if we recall our evolution discussion earlier, means that forces like genetic drift act way more strongly on the allelic frequencies in this population than would natural selection due to murder and warfare. Men and women getting trampled by an elephant would affect evolution more than murder and warfare in these situations. Not a compelling argument if you look at the science versus the mythology of male aggression and promiscuity. There are three interrelated fallacies at the core of sociobiology. First, and this is demonstrated by our genetic drift critique above, that they say that if something exists, it must be the product of natural selection, and that's just wrong. That's not science. Secondarily, they frequently play with the definitions of the parameters in order to pretend that something's universal when it's not, at least not across all human cultures or all human time. For example, what we would now call assisted suicide was called murder by Spanish missionaries observing indigenous people in Peru. Finally, even if a behavior is universal, found in all societies, it doesn't have to be genetic. I mean, their example of political economy disproves their whole point, that that is a force not genetic that is shaping the phenomena they're observing. If they included a discussion of modern society, all plausibility of their reproductive competition claim falls short. So here's where evolutionary psychology kicks in. They say, sure, these myths are not supported now, but when we were living back in caves eating mammoths, they did. And of course, our first objection that we just have to put right away is that we know very little about behavior in these times. We can find artifacts, we can even sequence caveman DNA, but behavioral assumptions based on available data is like if aliens landed on our planet, saw a hydroelectric dam, and said we were water goddess worshippers. Like, this is mythology. Although there are more reasonable examples, the fact that some of the ridiculous evopsych papers get published speaks volumes about the entire field. The popular press grows wild with headlines like, "Girls evolve to shop." I'm not joking, it's a real headline. They claim that because we ladies were gatherers while our men were hunters, we evolved a psychological satisfaction from going out and finding the best things and bringing them back home to our, cave, I suppose. I know, it was intense. And they can deal with the fact that some men love and other women hate shopping by saying that the caveman brain explains the average behavior and that some of us have just moved on, we're more evolved. So that means that the men in the crowd who love shopping, you are more evolved, you're more changed allelic frequency. That is what you are. Evopsych, one of the big problems here is that not only does dominant oppressive ideology benefit from these myths, sometimes there's actually a direct profit motive. So the study above was commissioned by a Manchester shopping mall. I'm not joking. Evopsych is actually commonly used in advertising. It's sponsored by companies that want to say that it's in our nature to want their product. Feminist blogger Rebecca Watson gave an awesome speech at Skepticon on evopsych, and in it she told of a researcher. Skepticon's pretty cool. And in it she told the story of a researcher who was approached by a PR company for a hair removal product. And they were looking for someone to conduct a survey of the top 10 sexiest walks for celebrities. And they would pay for this research themselves. They just needed a PhD to carry it out. And the email said, quote, "We feel having an expert commentary and an equation would give this story so much more weight. We haven't conducted the survey yet, but we know what the results we want to achieve are." They wanted Beyonce and curvy women to come out on top and Kate Moss to be less quote-unquote sexy walking. Then they asked how available the recipients of the email were this next month to conduct this research. And you would think that no one would do this, right? But that's wrong. The UK Telegraph ran the story a few months after the email had circulated, and The irony is, pesky data, it was actually Jessica Alba who had the sexiest walk, and Beyonce was only top five. But this is an example of science bought and sold. Finally, as we discussed earlier, the idea that there's a shopping module or even a competition module is painful. That's just not how either the brain or evolution works. It's not the brain, as those who attended yesterday's neuroplasticity talk know, is highly flexible and undergoes profound changes, making and breaking connections between neurons all the time. And the driving force of this is experience during the lifetime of the organism. That capability is highly adaptive, almost certainly a trait that has an evolutionary advantage, but the fact that that is true undermines any magical vision of an unchanging caveman set of instructions to grab women's hair or love pink. And if the behavior associated with a certain set of neuronal pathways is not inherited, it cannot be acted on by natural selection. But the modern reboot of behavioral genetics attempts to overcome all of these objections. Geneticists don't have to speculate on the Pliocene, and there's also a pretty clear, well-established link between evolution and a gene sequence. So the proponents of behavioral genetics feel more secure in their claims that they've hit upon a solid method to describe the biological determinants of human behavior. It's a cottage industry, mining the genome for just-so stories, to quote Stephen Jay Gould. Last month, three new headlines showed this clearly. Feeling hangry may be in our genes. Do y'all know what hangry means? Yeah. Hate IPAs, it's because your genetics programmed you. And the favorite, economists have identified a link between genetics and wealth inequality. From the trivial, so human evolution occurred before the IPAocene, to the mundane, most people don't feel happy when they're hungry. These kinds of stories usually just make me laugh and I can brush it off. But they represent a real threat, and it's demonstrated by the last headline. These economists got their hands on some genome data, used what other studies called intelligence, genes associated with intelligence, and compared those to income. And here's the funny thing that they found. The article, the popular press article said, it pays to be smart, but not too smart. I know. They found a relationship between these intelligence genes and income go up, 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 and then down a little. And I've actually seen, they were puzzled, but I've seen the shape of that curve before. Because that's the same shape as if you look at how many years you were in school and your income. Don't get a PhD if you want to make a lot of money. That's what that says. So it pays to be smart, but not too smart. You don't need DNA to explain that graph. That's a purely social phenomenon. There have been some serious advances in this field over the years, though. Instead of using individual genes or a few regions of the genome with high variability, the more recent versions use whole genome comparisons. So, in enormous success, scientists tie 52 genes to human intelligence, read the New York Times headline in May of this year. It was later May in this year. And a direct quote from the article, in the new study, Dr. Posthuma and her colleagues limited their research to people of European descent because that raised the odds of finding common genetic variants linked to intelligence. That's called cherry picking. You're not allowed to do that. But the authors of the study discussed in the article were careful to hedge. They said these genes aren't the only thing that determines intelligence. Nonetheless, the language of the article, which reaches the vast majority, used phrases like the genetic determinants or genes causing. This is a causal claim. So if I got that gene, I would magically be smarter. Setting aside the whole problem of the definition of intelligence, and please do read Stephen Jay Gould's Mismeasure of Man, it's the definitive work on this subject. This kind of causal claim for individual genes is a reductionist advance on sociobiology. Instead of making assumptions about heritability of a trait, behavioral geneticists assure the heritability part. They just miss the behavior part. In The problem is that by just comparing all human genomes that we've sequenced with some metadata, it doesn't show any significant correlations. Not if you include all of the proper controls that you should be having, like race and age and country and so on and so forth. You can find DNA sequences that are more common in people who got PhDs, but the significance of any correlation to an individual gene is minuscule. And maybe they just found genes associated with being a white male ancestor of the US founding fathers, right? That could have totally been what they found. So this is the equivalent of saying that if every person on a bus is wearing a coat, the bus must have caused the coat. And extending the analogy, perhaps it could be the weather, the context that caused the coats. Finally, as we remember from above, the presence or absence of a gene is only of passing interest when examining actual traits. Gene expression, the timing, location, and responsiveness to the environment can literally make or break an organism. For example, baby male rats secrete a compound in their urine that makes their mother lick their testes as they grow, and that actually changes gene expression in those baby male rats such that they upregulate testosterone and continue male maturation. And if you separate genetically male rats from their mothers, they actually have anatomical and hormonal differences from the ones that were with their mothers. So this is a profoundly dynamic and not genetically determined process of becoming who and what we are. One of the leaders of the Human Genome Project put it aptly. He says, "We've called the human genome a blueprint, the holy grail, all sorts of things. It's a parts list." If I gave you a parts list for the Boeing 747 and it had 100,000 parts, I don't think you could screw it together. And you certainly couldn't understand why it flew. So recap, and then our version of human nature. Sociobiology pretends things are universal. If so, they must be genetic. And if a trait exists, it must be natural selection. No. Evo-psych has way too little data on ancient conditions to assert what they do about the evolutionary forces then. Brain function can't be understood as mere modules. And finally, it's way too frequently funded by sources that have a real dog in that fight. And behavioral genetics is guilty of cherry-picking the samples for input, pretending causation and correlation are the same, and reducing the unit of selection to the point of irrelevance when you're talking about behavior. So, does all of this mean that I don't think we share important features with other animals? Not at all. We have the same basic needs as all animals: food, shelter, to live without disease, and sometimes we share ancestral traits to meet those needs, including some simple behaviors. Does this critique mean that evolution didn't shape us as a species, including some of the ways that we process and communicate information? There are species that are much more solitary than we are, yet our sociality, a behavior, as complicated as it is fundamental to our humanity. We would not have evolved as such without our sociality. And does this mean that genes don't influence behavior? Absolutely not. I'll give you a great example, though. Lots of people feel uncomfortable going out with friends for pizza because they know that the cheese will make them sick afterwards. So that's a genetic basis for a feeling, an emotion, right? See? What does it mean? What it does mean is that we have to have a view of human nature that's restricted enough in its claims to be valid, not just as a tool for people to justify the status quo, or worse yet, continue to attack the already oppressed. A view of human nature that fits what we know from science, including social sciences, and also wasn't paid for by Procter and Gamble. Humans do not have more genes than other species. Our genome is quite small compared to corn or lungfish. It does appear a general trend, however, that complex organisms have more non-protein coding, i.e. regulatory DNA, than more simple ones. And this suggests that our complexity as humans may stem in part from the ability to sense our environment over a period of time and adapt to it. We don't have the biggest brain either. Sperm whales have 3 times a bigger brain than we have. But we do have an incredible ability to form and break and reform connections for communication between our neurons based on our experience. And this is what I would call the biological basis of human nature. We are social, with biological adaptations like a highly versatile voice and a whole lot of facial muscles. We are curious and innovative, as is evidenced by our opposable thumb and our history of tool making. We're capable of a huge range of behaviors. This is why we can live in so many different places on the planet, why we can terraform, for better or worse. We have done so even more, on par with the birth of photosynthesis and the oxygenation of this planet. And this is also why Trump can be a version of our species. Yes, we must acknowledge this. But the same species is capable of risking everything to bring her child to safety from Guatemala. So, same species, profoundly different settings, profoundly different outcomes. We're so good at sociality and adaptation and innovation that we, to an unparalleled extent compared to other animals, we have a history. Our day-to-day existence right now is so profoundly different from 500 years ago. Given how slowly we reproduce, there's just no way that those changes could have an evolutionary basis. When ants build a new style of anthill, it's not because they read the ant archives and they imagined in their mind a better way to do it and then got their ant buddies to come make it with them. Often that's actually genetic. The different species make different style anthills. But we have, our dramatic transformation is the product of our genes and brains, truly, but indirectly. It is the special adaptability and sociality that allows us this cumulative, iterative process, an ability not just to receive input from our environment and react, but also to consciously change it, to evaluate, and then to change it better next time. And that's what I consider the essence of human nature. And given that this is our essence, it is no wonder that deterministic mythologies are asserted and asserted again. Because under the current system, only a few people in our species are supposed to change anything. And the rest of us are supposed to shut up and go back to our retail job. So to quote Marx, the animal is immediately one with its life activity. It is not distinct from that activity, it is that activity. Man makes his life activity itself the object of his will and consciousness. He has conscious life activity. Only because of that is he a species being. Only because of that is his activity free activity. And what does free activity look like? It means that all of us chose to take off work and be here today. It also means that oil executives can say the words clean coal and not choke on the irony. But that's human nature, and that it allows for the possibility of a completely different society of socialism. And if we talk about genes and brains as responsive to the environment, what can you imagine would a generation raised under something so much better be capable of doing? Their innovations, ethos, and cultural structures free of the muck of capitalism, that is what I'm fighting for, and I hope you join me.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.